Sponsorship of this KQED podcast is provided by San Francisco State University's graduate business programs offering 5 accredited advanced degrees, the SF State MBA, rigorous, real-world, respected, open house schedule, and more information at mba.sfsu.edu.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org, and URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. URSCorp.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, new policies on extreme isolation at California prisons. Plus, in San Francisco, domestic violence and politics. Why some say bad blood between the city's top law enforcement officials is driving prosecution of the sheriff.
They disagreed over community policing in his district and in the city. So there is a history there that is not a good one.
Also, it's the first appearance of a gray wolf in almost 90 years, but not everyone is cheering. And food trucks. They're hip, cool, and trendy. But now, chain restaurants want a slice of the action.
This is supposed to be more of like an underground, unique type thing where they fusion, give it their own flair. Corporate trucks, it's like you could just go to the restaurant.
It's the California Report. And we begin today with two very different stories of crime and punishment, starting with isolation policies for criminals, including many alleged gang members, in California prisons. Last year, hundreds of inmates staged 2 hunger strikes that spread to 13 prisons. The prisoners were protesting conditions in super maximum security units known as the SHU. Well, on Friday, the State Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation issued a new set of policies aimed at overhauling how these units are managed, who's sent in, and how long they're held in isolation. Reporter Michael Montgomery is following the story for KQED and the Center for Investigative Reporting, and he joins us now. Michael, as you well know, these issues have been around for many, many years. Why are they being addressed now?
Well, what the Department of Corrections is saying is that there have been these ideas on how to reform or change the way these units are run, these often windowless units where some men have been held for decades. Really, what the officials are saying now is they have more bed space. There's been a sharp reduction in the inmate population, and they have more flexibility now in the system in terms of how to move some of these people around while keeping them in a pretty secure situation. And this was a point that was made today by the department's undersecretary, Terry McDonald.
Public safety realignment has given us the opportunity to begin to implement research and policies that we've wanted to do for years, and haven't had the ability to do that because we were just so crowded.
So, Michael Montgomery, what does that mean for inmates, or what could it mean for inmates who are currently in these high-security units, these isolation units?
Well, what it means is that up until now, you've had situations where inmates have in some ways been trapped in these units. They can't get out, or they feel they can't get out. Now, under this new plan, there will be what they call a step-down program. Inmates, if they follow certain rules and take part in certain programs, will be moved from the most restrictive settings into a sort of transitional facility after 2 years. Now, that may seem like a long period of time in isolation, but it's much shorter than many of these inmates have had in previous, well, up to now.
And the strikers were asking for a lot of things to ease the conditions in isolation. How far do these policies go toward meeting those demands?
They go a certain degree. There will be more things inmates can have on the inside. Let me give an example. Right now, inmates in the security housing unit, say at Pelican Bay, have no phone calls to family. Under this new program, after one year, they'll get a phone call to a family member if they essentially behave. That might not seem like a huge change, but perhaps for an inmate, it is a big change.
One phone call a year. If they're
after
good.
2 years, they get 2 phone calls, etc. I don't think these proposals will address all of the issues of the strikers. But whether they'll launch another hunger strike is another question.
Now, as I remember it, one of the issues during the hunger strikes was how people get assigned to these units and who gets identified as a gang member and how. To what extent are those questions addressed in these policy changes?
This is a big point. Most of the inmates in these security housing units are alleged gang associates, not even members, but associates, people who have allegedly some relationship to gangs, but didn't necessarily do anything tangible for the gangs. Under the new policy, if you're branded as an associate, it no longer automatically sends you to the security housing unit. You have to be involved in criminal gang activity, according to the department. What's interesting about that is there are currently about 2,000 associates locked in these isolation units. The department has suggested it will review their cases, and possibly some or most or all of those inmates will be transferred out of these units and back into regular prison cells.
What about going the other direction? Could these changes lead to more people or different kinds of people being sent to isolation?
Yes, and this will be an area of controversy. The new criteria expands the groups or the threat groups that could be liable to be sent into these units. So it won't just be these seven prison gang groups. It could be groups like the Crips, sort of street gangs whose members are involved in illegal activities.
And is it fair to say, Michael, that the strikes that we saw last year were a direct cause of these policy changes?
Well, the department would never say that, but I think it's accurate to say that we would not be looking at these changes right now had the strikes not happened.
That's reporter Michael Montgomery following the story for KQED and the Center for Investigative Reporting. Michael, thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
Now on to San Francisco, where the sheriff, Ross Mercurimi, has been charged with domestic violence. The case is generating massive news coverage and charges of a prosecution tainted by local politics. On Friday, a three-judge panel ruled that a key piece of video evidence can be used in the upcoming trial. The 55-second clip reportedly has Mercurimi's wife, Eliana Lopez, crying and showing a neighbor bruises on her arm after an argument with her husband. Despite the video, Lopez, who's a telenovela star from Venezuela, is defending her husband.
I know what violence, domestic violence, is. And the real violence here is against me, is to put a family apart.
Mercurimi is facing three misdemeanor charges, including battery related to domestic violence and child endangerment, since the alleged incident happened in front of their young son. Initially, the court banned Mercurimi from having any contact with his wife or his son. Some, including Lopez, thought it was too harsh.
I feel like I am a ball, and everybody's using my family, myself, in a political game just for destroy Ross.
The last charge, that politics are driving this prosecution, is endorsed by former San Francisco Mayor Art Agnos.
Ross is not a violent person.
Agnos, like Mercurimi, is on the political left in a very liberal city that's been drifting ever so slightly toward the center lately. But last year, Mercurimi beat a more conservative candidate, strongly backed by the Police Officers Union and the district attorney, moving him from the Board of Supervisors to the sheriff's office. Agnos believes the aggressive pursuit of Mercurimi is a kind of political payback.
It's no secret that Ross has had a bad relationship or a difficult political relationship with the now DA and then police chief. They disagreed over community policing in his district and in the city. So there is a history there that is not a good one.
These charges against Mercurimi exploded just days before he was scheduled to take office, back in January. In his first public comments, Mercurimi said the matter was a private one between him and his wife. That notion infuriated domestic violence activists, including Karen Black.
That turns back the clock like 30, 40 years on the work of advocates who have, you know, really spent a career making sure that it's not a private matter, that it is in fact recognized as a crime.
Shortly after Mercurimi's statement, Black's organization, La Casa de las Madres, raised money for a San Francisco billboard. It read, Domestic violence is never a private matter. Mercurimi supporters say his treatment has been overly severe. They cite, among other things, the fact that he's never been charged with violence before. UC Hastings law professor Rory Little says cases like this are often resolved quickly and quietly, especially if there's no serious physical injury to the spouse or children.
It's often because the spouse does decide that she doesn't want to tear up their entire life. And with mediation and with some court supervision, you can prevent a further incident.
But Little disagrees with charges the case is driven by politics, especially given the dramatic video where Mercurimi's wife describes her injuries.
If you're a prosecutor in a domestic violence unit and you are given that kind of evidence, this is not a close case. In fact, you would have seen some incredibly heavy criticism of the government had they not charged this case, particularly since he's a high-ranking public official and a law enforcement official.
Because of all the media attention, Mercurimi's lawyer wants the trial moved out of San Francisco. And in the early stages of jury selection, hundreds of potential jurors have been dismissed. But law professor Rory Little thinks taking the case out of liberal San Francisco could end up hurting Mercurimi.
Normally, there's a conservative sympathy for law enforcement agents. At the same time, there's a real dislike of law enforcement agents who are domestic violence batterers. So it seems to me to be a sort of amazing gamble.
If this case goes to trial, it could expose not only Mercurimi's personal life, but also the soft underbelly of San Francisco politics, with its penchant for colorful personalities and petty feuds. Through it all, domestic violence activists, including Karen Black from La Casa de las Madres, hopes it will be a teachable moment.
And that the whole community really embraces it as a public health and a public safety problem for the city, and that we all come together to stop it.
Mercurimi has resisted calls to step aside until this matter is resolved. He could negotiate a plea agreement to avoid trial, and if he's ever convicted, he could be removed from office by the mayor and the Board of Supervisors. In any case, his political future is much less bright than it was on Election Day. For 2 months now, Northern California has been home to a lone gray wolf from Oregon. Its name, OR7. It made headlines as the first gray wolf in California in almost 90 years. And recently, the critter has been going back and forth between the two states. Environmentalists are excited, but for some residents, the wolf is not a welcome visitor. Reporter Lauren Summer traveled to Lassen County, where opposition to the wolf is heating up.
What we're here today to do is just to share with you what we know about wolves in California.
If there's one thing Karen Kovacs knows, it's that wolves make people emotional. Kovacs is with the California Department of Fish and Game, and for the past few weeks, she's been talking to the public about California's wolf. Today, she's at a county board of supervisors meeting in Susanville, a town in the state's rural northeast corner.
OR7 was collared in February of last year.
Kovacs' agency is tracking the 2-year-old male wolf with a radio collar. So far, OR7 has spent most of his time here in Lassen County, and that's made a lot of residents nervous.
They're here to tell you there's nothing to worry about. I'm from the government. I'm here to help you.
I feel sorry for the deer hunters and the elk hunters in Idaho, and I'm going to feel sorry for them here, too.
The protection afforded something that doesn't belong here in the first place doesn't make any sense.
The reception from county supervisor and rancher Bob Pyle isn't any warmer.
I really don't care what it is. It's killing my cattle. I'm going to kill them.
That sentiment has followed wolves from the moment they were reintroduced in the West almost 20 years ago. In states like Idaho and Montana, where wolf populations have rebounded, there's been an all-out war. Ranchers and hunters say wolves kill too many livestock and elk. Environmentalists see the wolf as a key part of a healthy ecosystem. With OR7's arrival, that debate has come to California.
The way we find his tracks is because they're pretty darn big.
I'm walking through a quiet pine forest outside of Susanville with Kovacs and fish and game biologist Richard Callis. OR7 crossed a major highway nearby a few weeks ago, not far from where California's last wolf was trapped and killed in 1924. OR7's exact location is secret to protect the wolf, but once he leaves an area, Kovacs and Callis go in to see what he's been eating.
We know that OR7 is fed on two deer. We don't know whether he killed them or scavenged them.
Life isn't easy for a wolf on his own, but there's a reason OR7 has traveled 2,000 miles since he left his pack in Oregon last September. He's looking for a companion.
Well, his love life hasn't been much to brag about lately, but he's certainly looking for a mate.
In other states, it's taken about 10 years for a pack to be established after the first wolf showed up. But Callis says biologists aren't sure how successful wolves will be here.
Our elk population is smaller than some states, like Montana or Colorado or Wyoming. Our deer numbers are lower than they were.
Since Oregon's wolf packs live hundreds of miles from the border, it could be some time before another wolf wanders this way. But for Kovacs, that may not matter. Groups on both sides are calling for some kind of plan to manage wolves.
There are entities out there who are ready to litigate at a drop of a hat. Can we get those stakeholders here in California to the table to collectively meet to move forward?
Stakeholders like Jack Hansen.
Yeah, well, we'll go ahead and feed.
It's a cold morning at Willow Creek Ranch outside of Susanville, where Hansen is getting ready to feed 300 hungry cattle. A few weeks ago, OR7 wasn't far from here.
17, 18 miles as the crow flies.
That way.
To the north, yeah, to the northeast.
Hansen says it's not OR7 that he's worried about. It's that wolf populations could grow. In other states, some ranchers are using tools to deter wolves, like special fencing and loud noises. Some even get text messages when wolves are close. But Hansen says most ranchers see them as one more thing to deal with in an already tough industry. Still, he wants to be part of the discussion.
We'll be able, I think, to have a dialogue with the agencies. I don't think it'll ever come to exactly where we want it, which is not to have them back in the first place.
Wolves are already protected in California under the Federal Endangered Species Act, but several environmental groups are petitioning the state to protect them under California law as well. That would require the Department of Fish and Game to figure out how many wolves belong in California and how they'll recover. The question is, can California avoid the battles that other states have seen?
No, I don't think so.
Ed Bangs recently retired from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He's been in the middle of the Western wolf debate for two decades.
You have to remember, wolves and wolf management has nothing to do with reality. I mean, we can give you the facts, you know, all this kind of biology stuff. That isn't what people talk about. They're talking about what wolves mean to them symbolically.
But he thinks that debate isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Imagine if it was, you know, the way it was before, where no one cared at all about natural resources or wildlife. Apathy is a lot worse.
Just 30 years ago, there were only a handful of gray wolves in the West. Today, there are more than 1,600. For the California Report, I'm Lauren Sommer.
Whether you love or hate the gray wolf, we'd love to hear what you think about stories you hear on the California Report. Send your email to calreport@kqed.org. You can also comment on specific stories online. Just go to californiareport.org. While you're there, you'll see everything we archive. And if you feel like listening on your own time, check out our podcast. You can sign up for it at californiareport.org or look for us at iTunes. Maybe it's the sun-splashed landscape and proximity to the beach, or the allure of lucrative work in Hollywood, but Brazilian musicians have been flocking to Southern California for more than 50 years. Guitarist Oscar Castro Neves was an early arrival, and he's thrived as a player, producer, and arranger. The California Report's jazz critic Andrew Gilbert reviews his new CD live at the Blue Note Tokyo.
While Oscar Castro Neves has lived in Southern California for more than four decades, his musical world is still defined by Rio de Janeiro, where he grew up. The guitarist, vocalist, arranger, and composer has been in the thick of Brazilian popular music since he was a teenager. When singer Alaide Costa had a hit in 1960 with his tune Chora Tua Tristeza, the recording heralded the emerging bossa nova movement. Castro Neves's new album, Live at the Blue Note Tokyo, is a love letter to bossa nova. Mostly avoiding the obvious standards, the concert is less an exercise in nostalgia than a celebration of the style's enduring beauty.
Chora que a tristeza foge do teu olhar, brincando de esquecer, saudade vai passar e o amor já vai chegar então.
That's Castro Neves with Rio-based vocalist Leila Pinheiro on that first hit, Chora Tua Tristeza, one of the album's highlights, and a piece that showcases his beautiful touch on the guitar. He never plays a flashy or extraneous note, rendering the distilled samba groove that's the essence of bossa nova with the requisite restraint. But rather than focus on his own songs, Castro Neves explores tunes by fellow masters like Baden-Powell, Luis Bonfá, and Edu Lobo. Throughout the album, Castro Neves provides Pinheiro with gorgeous, almost invisible arrangements, as you might expect from an artist who's recorded with Sarah Vaughan and Ella Fitzgerald. Here, he eases her into a Jobim medley of Domingo Azul do Mar and Fotografia.
Quando eu vi o seu olhar sorrindo para mim nesse domingo, Domingo azul do mar, eu compreendi que nada terminou. Vi então...
Castro Neves's other featured guest is another giant of Brazilian music who's called Los Angeles home for decades, Ayrton Moreira, a pioneering jazz percussionist who gained fame with Miles Davis and Weather Report. He provides subtle support throughout, then lets loose on his improvised feature, Caninana. Castro Neves has also collaborated with numerous jazz stars, most recently as an accompanist for harmonica great Toots Thielemans. His love of jazz suffuses the CD, particularly on his graceful introductions. The only thing that keeps Live at the Blue Note from being the definitive Oscar Castro Neves album is the dearth of his original songs, but it's got everything else.
O homem que diz do não dá.
Andrew Gilbert is a San Francisco Bay Area writer who covers jazz and world music. He reviewed Live at the Blue Note Tokyo by Oscar Castro Neves. The food truck frenzy has been on a roll throughout California, with more vendors revving up all the time. Some are run by small independent entrepreneurs. Others are linked to trendy restaurants run by red-hot chefs. But as reporter Susan Vallett explains, in Southern California, they're getting some controversial competition. Chain restaurants.
Hi, gentlemen. How are you guys doing today?
Good. How are you?
Workers from the Habit Burger Truck deal with a lunchtime crowd at an industrial park in Rancho Cucamonga, east of Los Angeles.
It comes with mayo, lettuce, tomato, and Swiss cheese with grilled onions and barbecue sauce on wheat. It's really good.
The Habit's a four-decade-old, mostly California chain that's been expanding. The Habit's Mike Merkel says the burger chain rolled out its first food truck doing catering events late last summer. A local business paid for it to come out today.
The truck can allow us to go places and serve people where we don't necessarily have a physical restaurant.
Merkel says the truck is a great marketing tool to create brand awareness.
You know, we're not a McDonald's that's on every other corner, and we do have a lot of fans who have experienced us in other places, and so the truck is really something that we can take to them.
The idea isn't new. In-N-Out rolled out its first catering truck in the mid-1980s, doing special events. But with the food truck craze really taking off in L.A. in the last couple of years, more and more trucks linked to chain restaurants are popping up, including Sizzler's Double Z truck. Unlike the Habit or In-N-Out's truck, Sizzler's Double Z travels with the independent food truck crowd.
One French dip slider?
No, make it two.
Two with fries or without?
Sizzler workers take orders on iPads while a satellite TV blares nearby. Nearly everything on the menu is new, making the truck sort of a test kitchen for the long-established but recently declining Sizzler chain. Chris Rader is the chef in charge.
I mean, it's a way for us to help rebuild, you know, Sizzler, because it's gone to a plateau and then it's come down, and now it's kind of, we're trying to use this as a vehicle to propel it up, you know, as a marketing scheme, as getting out with the people and things like that. So it kind of revitalizes that the youth of Sizzler, so it's not just, you know, going after one crowd.
Meaning the senior crowd that the chain's become known for. And Rader says Sizzler's truck, which hit the road in August, goes where Sizzler already is. He says he doesn't think corporations entering the food truck fray will run the little guys out of business.
Just like brick and mortar restaurants, there's always going to be great mom and pop restaurants, and then there's going to be these corporate, you know, Applebee's and everything else that's going to be out there. So I don't think that it'll do anything is changing the landscape of having somebody, of creating grilled cheese truck. The only thing that it'll really do is people will vote with their money on the food. It doesn't matter if we have iPads to order with or if we plaster a TV on the side of it. It's going to come down to what people think of the food.
Food truck follower Addie Arboleta says she probably won't try the corporate trucks.
This is supposed to be more of like an underground, unique type thing where they fusion, give it their own flair. Corporate trucks, it's like you could just go to the restaurant.
Arboleta is among dozens of folks at a food truck gathering in southern L.A. County. Others in line with her say they might give the corporate trucks a try, just to see how they're different. John Self, a restaurant expert at Cal Poly Pomona, says the chains are going after not only branding, but new money from a new market. He expects most chains will roll out food trucks.
And the winner is going to be the public. And I think the winner will be the restaurant industry, because it'll expand into a totally different new market. It's just like when you see the restaurants put it in grocery stores.
But will those corporations whip the little guys? Chef Roy Choi, the co-founder of LA's popular Kogi Korean taco truck, welcomes the challenge.
This is a chance for these companies, with their power and their access and their marketing and their connection and their ability to get food out there, for us to create what I've been dreaming of all along, is like hawker centers in America, you know? So if we go that route, I'm all for it.
Kogi Truck chef Roy Choi says there will always be an independent spirit among food trucks, no matter what, spirit that attracts a loyal following. But will the corporate trucks spread to other parts of California? San Diego is already seeing a few. But so far, the San Francisco Bay Area is sticking with mostly indies for now. For the California Report, I'm Susan Vallett in Los Angeles.
That's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Racho. Seal Muller is our technical producer. Additional engineering by Howard Gelman and Paul Ancour. The senior online editor is Gabriel Cohen, with help from David Marks. Our interns are Andres Barraza and Liz Reed. Our senior producer this week is Victoria Maleon. The producer is Polly Stryker. Andrea Kissick was a contributing editor. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, with nomination information about the 2013 Leadership Awards at www.irvine.org, and the California Endowment, building healthy communities because that's where health happens. More information at calendow.org.